You're listening to Catholic Chicago Week in Review on Relevant Radio 950 AM and 930 AM. During the next hour, the Archdiocese of Chicago brings you conversation about the people, events, and issues that touch our lives. Welcome to Catholic Chicago Week in Review.
Good morning, I'm Jim Dish with the Archdiocese of Chicago's Radio TV office. Happy to be with you on Relevant Radio. Every Saturday morning, we bring you highlights of our Catholic Chicago radio programs that air throughout the week. Lots of great discussion this week, starting with our Catholic Schools Today program, hosted by Catholic School Superintendent Dr. Jim Rigg and Graziano Marcheschi of Shalom Media. They talked about the importance of service projects with representatives of Trinity High School.
During this segment, we're going to be speaking about Trinity High School students who volunteer for many service projects throughout the school year. Their international baccalaureate program, the first in the Archdiocese of Chicago over 20 years ago, requires students to provide service hours. Guests via telephone, Jamie Visser, the campus minister, who may still be leading the morning prayer. We're not quite sure if she's with us yet. And Rose Cernovich, the international baccalaureate director. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You're both here.
Yes.
All right. So you got your kids all tucked away and prayed and ready for another week of school.
Absolutely.
So Dr. Jim is here, and I'm sure he's going to have lots of questions for you. But my first question is, if you would please tell us about the International Baccalaureate Program. For many folks, that's going to be a new term. Tell us what that is and how you've integrated it at Trinity High School.
Sure. Well, the IB International Baccalaureate Program is internationally renowned, and it has just celebrated its 50-year anniversary. We adopted the program 25 years ago as a means of really establishing Trinity as a respected academic institution that would be unique in its curriculum offering. So currently it is our honors program, and we have about 65% of our student body involved in some aspect of the IB program.
So what does the IB program involve?
Well, it's a study of the six different subject areas, which would include English language literature, world languages, social studies and science, math and the arts. So students may, as they would, for instance, in the advanced placement program, elect to take several subjects, or they could take the entire range of IB courses. They're studying at a college level. They're working collaboratively. They're doing a lot of writing, which is the strength, really, of the IB. It's very writing-based. They're doing research. And again, this is all for possibly college credit, but also for a rich academic experience.
So is the main difference between IB and a typical high school curriculum that there's a greater focus on literature and art?
Not necessarily a greater focus, perhaps a deeper focus. It's a little bit more, I would say, intense. It's definitely at a college level. Higher expectations, for instance, in terms of the ability to analyze, to draw connections, to synthesize information, to do research. So it definitely is very much a liberal arts model, but it also will prepare students for the kind of rigor that they will be expecting on the college level.
I've had a chance to get into Graz, every one of the Catholic schools, and remember clearly my first time at Trinity High School. It was several months ago during their May crowning service, mm-hmm. and Sister Michelle, the former president of the school, showed me around and showed me the IB program, and it seems very, very strong. Students seem to be really engaged in that particular approach. I guess, Rose, now that you're, first of all, were you there 25 years ago? I'm sorry to ask this, when the program first started?
Yes. Okay. In fact, I was one of the so-called pioneers of the program.
Okay,
and
great.
I was teaching English at the time. And now I'm still teaching English, the senior IB mm-hmm. English program, and I'm also coordinating. So I have the advantage of seeing it from both both angles.
And so 25 years later, are you pleased with the program? Do you think that it has achieved what it set out to do?
Absolutely, and beyond our expectations. That's I would great. Say the involvement of the students, as I mentioned, we have about 65% of our student body and growing. Our goal is to have 100% involved in the IB in some capacity, whether it's one class or the entire program. So in that 25 years, we've also seen the addition of several subject areas, again, based on our student needs. So that's been exciting to really see it grow and develop to meet the needs of our student population and to have that a success rate.
I imagine that participation in an IB program is a good credential for getting into college. What is it about IB that universities would value?
Well, they certainly would see the IB candidate, whether they're a full diploma candidate or in the partial program, as an asset. They know that this is a student that has taken risks, is well-balanced, they're open-minded, they're reflective, you know, that they have experienced a rigorous curriculum based on writing and research, on collaboration, not just memorizing content, but really being able to apply critical thinking skills. That is something that is so critically needed in our world today, and certainly for any future jobs, vocations that students will be pursuing. And so that area of the IB, that ability to really think divergently and creatively as well as critically, that's something that universities value.
Yes, yeah. And something that we need in this
Absolutely.
Day and age.
Yes.
Now, IB is not program specific to Catholic schools. International baccalaureate schools can be public or non-Catholic private.
Right.
However, Trinity, of course, is a Catholic high school. So turning now to Jamie, the campus minister, how is IB uniquely lived out in the context of a Catholic school?
I think that their commitment to service and engaging communities both close to us and far away from us does give it a unique lens that is, I guess, multi-layered. It's not just about the commitment to the IB program, but rather rooted in our values as a Cincinnati Dominican Catholic school.
That's great. And tell us a little bit more about the service program that goes alongside IB, Jamie.
Sure. So each student is required to perform service during every year during their time at Trinity. It's part of the fabric of our life here, and so it is, you know, a graduation requirement. And each year we ask that students really thoughtfully consider what are their passions and their interests and what are the needs of the world that may be matched by, you know, their unique gifts. So we partner with them to try to make sure that their hours of service are meaningful and transformative for both themselves and the communities that they serve.
So give us a sense about some of the service opportunities that your students are involved in.
Absolutely. So students both choose to find their own opportunities in their own communities, especially because we do come from a wide variety of geographical locations. But we also do try to provide opportunities for their service here at Trinity or at least in conjunction with campus ministry. So that looks different for every student, but about once a month, campus ministry hosts with our service committee, which is comprised of faculty and staff. We host service opportunities that any student who would like to can be involved in. So this year so far, we did a cleanup day in Bemis North Woods. We did a St. Nicholas service day and party at Hepzibah Home in Oak Park. We also, alongside our commitment to service, we do a couple of all-school service-related charitable donation drives, and our Blazer Seeking Justice Club in November did our Thanksgiving food drive for Marillac St. Vincent.
All right. Congratulations to all the faculty, staff, and students involved in those Trinity High School service projects. On our Black Catholic Initiative radio program, Deacon John Cook talked with Thomas Drexler, an advocate for the homeless.
We're talking about, Thomas, the retreats that you've had, and you said that you have them separate, men and women, and I understand that. And these retreats that you do, too, are sort of different in themselves. I know you do one-day retreats, and then you do, like, weekend retreats, right?
Yes.
How do they differ?
Well, the overnight retreat, obviously, it's going to be simply 12 people, 12 retreatants.
Okay.
And then three facilitators, and then one former retreatant who acts as a witness.
Mm.
And he or she plays a really key role on the retreat, because they will tell their story, and it allow and really break open then other people's stories. It gives other people to the permission to tell their own story, and it's all rooted in story, the pain, the struggle, but then also beginning to locate God in that story, and the realization that even with that pain and struggle, God has been there. There's an encounter with God on the retreat where, you experience his unconditional love. And, Deacon John, that changes everything.
Oh,
that experience
I know.
Of God's
oh,
love.
Oh, yes, it does. It has changed me in my life. So I know very well what you're talking about. So the 12 people, though, the retreatants, is that in the program, the 12-step program? Is that how it was initially set up, or the number 12? Why do you?
Yeah, no,
yeah.
That's an interesting question. No, we chose 12 because of group dynamics.
Yeah, I like that number.
That's usually that's usually as large as you want to go mm-hmm. to still have an intimate conversation mm-hmm. with a group of people.
Yeah, I think it's awesome because it's like a small classroom.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes.
Kids can excel a whole lot better with smaller numbers than it would be if it was overcrowded.
Right.
So you have some other people, or I should say organizations, that are going to be joining you next Tuesday for this National Memorial for Homelessness.
Right.
And so tell us a little bit about this event itself.
Sure. Well, five organizations came together to sponsor this memorial. And that would be the Ignatian Spirituality Project, a music therapy group that also has a choir of homeless men and women. That organization is called Harmony, Hope, and Healing.
Oh, wow.
And then the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless, as I mentioned earlier,
mm-hmm.
Old St. Pat's Church, and that's where it's located,
mm-hmm.
and then Franciscan Outreach, which is an emergency shelter and other homeless services.
Those are the friends who told us about this event. And had you come to us.
Sure.
So we're excited to have all of you guys involved in
right.
this project. So that particular day, what will it look like?
Yeah, it's really a beautiful service. It's a memorial.
Okay.
It's a liturgy. And what it does is that it memorializes those women and men who've died on the streets, who've died alone.
There's a story that I have here of a Raymond Ferguson. And he's downtown, or was downtown, but he died on June the 18th. And it seems that he was very popular. Do you know this story?
I'm not familiar with Raymond's story.
Mm-hmm.
But his will be one of 50, 60 names that are read. We'll have a solemn reading of the names.
Okay.
And we'll have a little piece of each person's story to accompany the reading of his or her name.
And so it's an interfaith candlelight vigil.
Yes.
And so what other pastors, churches do
sure.
you have involved this particular day?
Sure. Reverends Marcus and Robin Tabb will be the presiders.
Okay.
At the liturgy. We'll have readings from Scripture. We'll have a reflection from someone who is currently homeless to tell his or her story and to raise consciousness about homelessness.
Mm.
We'll have, obviously, some beautiful music from the Harmony, Hope, and Healing Choir. And then we'll have this solemn reading of names. And during that, then right after the solemn reading of names, we have a candlelight service where one by one everyone's candle is lit throughout the church. And it's a sign that, yes, people have died on the streets, but we know now that they're with the Lord, and that there can be still hope in this world because God is calling them to something greater.
You know, it's just something, this situation we're in with homelessness. It's hard to believe that so many people are homeless. Thomas, give us some demographics of what that looks like here locally and abroad.
Sure. Well, I can speak locally.
Okay.
In the last count that was comprehensive was back in 2016.
Okay.
And in that count, it was just amazing how many people were homeless, over 80,000 people. Now, some of that comes from doubling up.
Okay.
So people who have lost their housing and are sleeping on couches, are, you know, spending some time, you know, in a friend's house. But individuals, over 44,000 would be individuals of that 80,000. Over 30,000 would be families. So families with children that are experiencing homelessness, and then over 11,000 are unaccompanied youth, which is just amazing, the growing problem with youth homelessness.
And you know, Thomas, I've had I guess some experience myself just working with a local Chicago public high school, where I learned that this particular student or that student is staying with a friend,
right,
or they're staying with an aunt. They're considered homeless.
Well, in some counts, yes.
Okay.
Because it's housing insecurity. They're not sure that that couch is going to be available.
Wow.
They're not sure that that aunt or uncle is going to be able to continue to afford to feed and house them.
Yeah, when we had Candace Anderson here last week, she's with DePaul, I think it's Incorporated or something like that, I forget, I apologize, audience, but Candace mentioned that, you know, they have college students that are homeless.
Yes.
And I'm asking, how does that happen? How does one go to college and they're homeless?
I believe that organization was DePaul USA.
That's it, thank you.
Yeah.
DePaul USA, yes.
No, it's amazing that kids actually attend college while living in shelters.
They not only need to have their tuition paid in full, you know, but they also need to have a home provided for them.
Well, thankfully, DePaul USA provides that housing for at least some students.
That's awesome.
The Homeless Persons Memorial will be held Tuesday, December 18th at 6:30 p.m. at Old St. Patrick's Church in the West Loop. In a moment, we'll let you know how Catholic Charities is helping families in crisis, back after a short break.
Have you checked out Chicago Catholic lately? Either in print or online, Chicago Catholic has informative and stimulating content, including news from the Archdiocese, beautiful photographs, and a thoughtful column by our publisher, Cardinal Blaise Supich. Editor Joyce DeRiga tells us about our current edition of Chicago Catholic.
We talked to officials of our Catholic hospitals about security in place following the shooting at Mercy Hospital. I visit with survivors of the Our Lady of the Angels school fire on the 60th anniversary of the tragic blaze. The God Squad sets up its manger in Daly Plaza, and we have recommendations on some of the best books you can give for Christmas.
Subscribe now. Go to ChicagoCatholic.com or call 312-534-7777. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Chicago Catholic, a fresh approach to Catholic news.
What looks more peaceful than a sleeping baby? I'm Monsignor Mike Boland with Catholic Charities. So often mothers and fathers come to us, homeless, hungry, and hopeless, with a sleeping infant. They remind me of a cold, starry night and a mother, father, and their sleeping infant in Bethlehem. Because of your help, there is always room in our inn and hope. Visit us at CatholicCharities.net. God bless you and Merry Christmas.
Welcome back to Catholic Chicago Week in Review, where we bring you highlights from Archdiocese of Chicago radio programs that air Monday through Friday from 8 to 9 in the morning on WNDZ 750 AM. This past week, Catholic Charities President Monsignor Michael Boland and his guests talked about their much-needed outreach to families in crisis.
You know, this time of year can be happy for so many people, but for a family in crisis, it can be a difficult time. Many individuals and families can experience unforeseen events, such as losing a job or a home, or struggling to pay bills, provide food for their families, or to stay warm this winter. Out of an estimated 550,000 homeless people in the United States, about 35% are homeless families. In addition, 40 million Americans struggle with hunger, the same as the number of people officially living in poverty. A loss of a job can lead us to overwhelming feeling of stress, especially when a family needs a warm place to sleep at night and food security. People often ask, where do those individuals and families turn to? Catholic Charities is often on the front line, helping to ensure people have basic necessities and resources they need, especially during the cold winter months. Catholic Charities Family Stabilization Services provides assistance to families in need of emergency food or clothing or housing, employment assistance, and referrals. It's amazing to think, especially when we know that how cold it has been, and as we face the next several months in such cold weather, to know what it's like as we go from our cars or we stand for a bus, to realize how many people actually live in the streets, and there is no place that's warm for them to kind of go to. I'm very grateful this morning to be joined by Sharon Tillman, who is our director of Catholic Charities Family Stabilization Services, and Kendrea Atkins, who is our program supervisor of Catholic Charities Workforce Development, our EPIC and SNAP Employment Training. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you both with us today.
And I'm absolutely delighted to be here with you this morning.
Both your smiling faces is kind of nice, especially in the cold morning. Yeah. It's wonderful. Maybe, Sharon, you could tell us a little about the Family Stabilization Program and how, you know, people come to Catholic Charities, what are they looking for, especially in the winter months?
You know, I think you said it best. You kind of described the clients that we work with. Those are folks who've experienced some kind of a crisis that led them to needing primarily their basic human needs, whether that's food, whether that's housing, those kind of needs. But I think the thing that also that folks are coming to Catholic Charities looking for is that welcoming, affirming kind of situation where you've been out here and things have been so rough and folks have kind of either avoided you or in some kind of way just kind of mistreated you or even just ignored you. And so I think what they need from us is that welcoming piece, that affirming piece, that we're here for you, that even if we don't have everything that you're looking for, that we can provide some level of hope. Now, folks come in primarily right now looking for those things that happen in the wintertime. You know, winter exacerbates everything. Winter is the time that it's so cold outside till you might be homeless, and maybe you could make it a little better in the summer. But come wintertime, then, you know, these elements are too much to try to deal with. Or you've been able to pay your utility bills. Mm-hmm. And at this point, your gas bill has skyrocketed, so you're asking for help. And we're just a couple of days away from the holidays. And who doesn't want to have a turkey for their family? Right. So those are the kind of things that they're coming in looking for us to help with.
Yeah. It is just really, it's hard for some of us to realize that how many, both young adults and families, are really just a few paychecks away. You know, they don't sometimes always think if they're working, they're going to, it's fine. But if they get sick or, mm-hmm. you know, something, just one hiccup in
just
their
one.
Day,
yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, they don't. Many people don't think about savings, or there's just no way to save on their income, and so, you know, there isn't like a cushion. We always talk about, you know, you hear these commercials about, you know, people having, you know, a cushion of how many months or how many years salary or whatever. Well, that's wonderful, but that's unrealistic for so many people, especially people that turn to Catholic Charities and realize these bills come in every month, you know, and it's hard sometimes, especially when they fluctuate, like the heating bill or electrical bill
yes.
or or whatever. So, you know, it's I think it's a blessing for them to know that there is a place like Catholic Charities mm-hmm. that is there.
Yes.
With wonderful staff that you have that are on the front lines who are, you know, welcoming. And I always talk to our new employee orientations. I always try to tell them, you know, when our clients come in, people come to us for help. Yes. The word they hear all the time is no.
Yes.
We don't do this. We don't do that. Go someplace else. You know, whatever. And I says, you know, we have to try to be not the word no.
That's
we have to
right.
try to say, how do we connect
That's
them?
That's right.
And to say, you know, so I try to make sure our staff say, you have to think about knowing mm-hmm. so you can pick up the phone. Mm-hmm. And would you have someone sit in your office or you meet them and say, hey, why don't, you know, I'm going to connect you right now with this person. And they can actually either help you or try to help you or connect you with someone who can. But the idea that just says, well, go someplace else, that I think is so demoralizing.
Absolutely.
And then it makes people angry because they, you know, they don't understand, like, one program. They don't understand the qualifications sometimes mm-hmm. or, you know, how does this mom with her mm-hmm. kids get to mm-hmm. another location mm-hmm. on a bus? So who can afford that? I mean, it's just interesting, you know. I think the more we can integrate our staff with the knowledge of, you know, learning about what we can do and how we can do it. I think we can, you know, as much as we can be, you know, a welcoming place, because that to me is so critical that mm-hmm. we are a welcoming place and we, you know, that for sometimes when we're the first time somebody said hello to them,
That's
you know,
right.
or
right.
welcome them or hit a chair for them to sit on, you mm-hmm. know. Mm-hmm. And so those are they're simple things, but in reality they're huge, mm-hmm. you know, a part of that. What are some of the reasons that a person coming to Catholic Charities may have caused them?
Well, unemployment, underemployment. We have been dealing with, there's been big fires that have happened. Sometimes it's an electrical problem. Sometimes there are other things that are intentionally set. We responded to some of those fires, even in the northern parts of our city.
Right.
Folks are coming in sometimes because there's a domestic violence situation.
Mm-hmm.
And that person has to relocate immediately. Folks are coming in, especially during this time, just needing a warm coat. I mean, when you get through paying everything else and just trying to survive with paying the rent and the utilities, you need a warm coat. Your kids need warm coats and scarves and hats and that kind of thing. So during the wintertime, we do a lot of that. Our clothing numbers kind of escalate during the wintertime because folks are needing that clothing. And, of course, food. You know,
yes.
you eat a little more heartily in the wintertime than you do in the summertime.
Yeah.
So things go fast.
And I just know that I was in our lobby a couple weeks ago, and a gentleman brought a woman who was walking around City Hall and needed help,
mm-hmm.
and she did not hear. She was deaf, and but it was just interesting. You know, he brought her all the way down into the lobby, and then to see about getting help. I think that she was overwhelmed by the fact that someone came out from your office, and visited with her and talked mm-hmm. with her and mm-hmm. communicated with her, and then, you know, the whole idea about connecting her to things. I mean, but it was I think because Catholic Charities has a great reputation that just. This person, you know, in City Hall says, well, they will help you.
Yeah.
And brings her down to the line. I mean, took that much effort. It's a blessing.
Yes,
again,
it is.
That people know, you know, that those are just really important parts of contact.
Mm-hmm.
I know many times caseworkers are the first point of contact with someone in distress or with a person who might need emergency assistance. Can you give us some steps that a worker takes to ensure a family receiving the services in need?
Sure. We have a trained staff. We have mainly bachelor-level social workers who actually sit down with that client. And most of our clients come in just seeking, if they're coming in seeking food, one of the things that those workers do is first and foremost do what we call a holistic assessment. And when they do that holistic assessment, they're looking at all the other areas of their lives, whether that's housing, whether that's what their income is, what their education is, and all those things that it's going to take to try to see whether or not this person can be, their situation can be stabilized. You know, recently we changed our name from Emergency Assistance to Family Stabilization Services. And we changed that because it's a little bit more indicative of what we really want to do.
Yes.
We want folks to be able to get into a situation that they don't have to repeatedly come to us.
Mm-hmm.
So that worker sits down and looks at the whole situation and kind of goes from a strengths perspective with that client and says, well, let's look at, first of all, what you do have, what you do well, what maybe is active in your life. And then let's put that all together and try to look at those needs And if it's something that's immediate that we can handle, say, for instance, if it's clothes or if it's food or those kind of, or even if it's finance, some financial assistance. Now, it's limited financial assistance, but some financial assistance. We just don't have enough money for everything.
Right.
But we try to provide whatever that need is. And if it's something that we don't have immediately on site, then we refer. You know, we have linkage agreements with other folks. We have MOUs with other folks, memorandums of understanding. We have just relationships with other folks that we can call out and say, help us. We have 150 programs plus that mm-hmm. We are that entry point that we can send folks out and say, well, we can't do it right now. We're going to call that person for you, set up that appointment with you, and follow through mm-hmm. and make sure that that happened for you.
Go to CatholicCharities.net to learn more about how Catholic Charities assists more than 1 million people every year without regard to religious, ethnic, or economic background. On our Lifelong Journey program, Patricia Malinowski, Juan Padilla, and Victor Garcia talked with Father Louis Camelli about his new book on family life.
Father has written a book. It's called A New Vision of Family Life, a reflection on Amoris Laetitia. And it is packed. I have read this, and it is amazing.
Yes,
I
yes.
have post-its, blue post-its
oh, wow.
all over, because there's so much here. It's a treasure.
Thank you, Patricia. Yes. Thank you.
You are welcome, Father.
That's very kind of you.
Thank you, Father. Now, Father, maybe just a little extra you want to add for our listeners as about yourself and how you came about writing this book?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm a priest of the Archdiocese of Chicago. I've been ordained, almost 49 years. 49 years. I know I don't look it.
You look really young.
Yeah, I was ordained. I was ordained at 3 years old.
No. Thank you, sir. But
I'm a priest of the Archdiocese. I have spent most of my priesthood working in formation in the seminary and then with priests. And I've worked with different agencies and departments of the diocese and also with Cardinal Supich. So in any case, The book, A New Vision of Family Life, A Reflection on Amoris Laetitia, actually goes back to the time of Cardinal George, who asked me to collate all the responses in preparation for one of the synods on family life, you know. And so I did that, and it was an extraordinary experience for me to pull in all these things. And then Archbishop Supich came to Chicago, and there was another sounding, and I did that again. And then I accompanied Archbishop Supich to the synod, the second synod on the family. Wow. So out of that experience, which I found very touching and moving, I wanted to share what I think is an extraordinary vision of Pope Francis for family life. But also, how can I explain this? It's a really a new vision for the Church overall, situating family right at the center. So that's a bit of background for the book.
And that's awesome. And my understanding is that you were ordained in Rome in 1969.
That's right.
That's a beautiful beautiful thing. It's a beautiful country, isn't it, Father? Rome is, yes.
Well, yeah, I lived there 7 years. It was a wonderful experience. I have family there.
So you have family in Italy.
It was a great experience. And I was ordained at the altar of the chair. And the far back wall, was wonderful.
That's beautiful.
Yep.
Well, thank you for being here, Father. I also read the book. It's an amazing book. It has so much wisdom. And it's in this culture in where we live, there is so much thing going on, and family want to be modified. And I love the formation piece you got in here.
Yeah.
The way you put it, like the people is in the journey, that we got these ideas of how family should be,
right.
And some people, they are not there yet.
Right.
But we are supposed to be in the journey. Like I love the compassion is written here.
Yeah.
Like it's no blaming anybody. It's like the way you put it is people in the journey, and it's getting there. By graduation, how do you call the theory of graduation?
By stages.
Stages,
And growth.
And that's beautiful. I mean, that's what we need
in
our society more than ever. Like graduation, little by little, is not like tomorrow I'm going to wake up and I'm going to be super Catholic
and
the best disciple of Jesus. That formation piece is amazing.
Well, thank you, Victor. Yeah. I hope what I was doing was simply reflecting what Pope Francis is doing in the apostolic exhortation Amoris Laetitia. Yeah. Because you see, this is really very, very important. The Holy Father has written a formation document. Yeah. It's not primarily about doctrine. It's not primarily about moral theology, or it's not about devotion, but it's about formation. It's laying out. It assumes all the teaching of the Church, doctrine and moral and so forth. But then what the Holy Father wants to do is he wants to help people, bring them along on the journey.
Yes,
And that's just really very, very important. In effect, what he's doing is he is like a spiritual father, a spiritual director for the whole Church. Yeah. I mean, that's extraordinary.
Well, that's a big,
yeah, it really is. But he's offering us guidance so that we can carry on and move. And I think something that you mentioned, yes. I think I also yes. want to pick up on the journey. Yes. People who are good people, religious people, yes. spiritual people, are highly idealistic people.
Yes.
You know, and so we feel like, oh, well, we should be there already.
Yes.
Well, no. No, I mean, yes. it's a yeah. journey.
Yes.
And sometimes on the journey, the pilgrimage, the pilgrim people of God, sometimes they make detours, sometimes they make mistakes, sometimes they go backwards.
Yeah.
But always, if they're faithful, they'll stay with the journey, and the Holy yeah. Spirit will guide them. They will. They will move forward. They will move forward. So we have to be realistic, and I think the Holy Father, as a formation person, as a spiritual director, mm-hmm. is very realistic.
Oh, yeah.
Father, now, we're getting today. This week was the first week of Advent.
Yeah.
So we're preparing. We're readying ourselves. And your book is leading us through ways that we can do that. Now, one of the areas that you highlight after every chapter is reflection.
Yes.
Can you share for our listeners the significance of reflection in our lives?
Yeah, let me focus it maybe even more specifically to reflection in families.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Because I think very often what happens to us, and again, these are good people, yeah. good families, people of faith, people who go to church, people who pray. Yeah. But in our families, we don't necessarily talk mm-hmm. about our faith, or
yes,
we don't reflect together. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think this is an invitation to change that, to do that, you know, and in a kind of special way to reflect on how God is moving in our family
yeah.
and what is God calling us to.
Thank you, Father, for that clarification, yeah. because generally when we do think of reflection, we think of quieting ourselves
yeah,
and
yeah.
going
personal
off
personal reflection, which is,
yes.
that's important
yes.
too, yeah.
So now we're personalizing, but yet we're engaged, that connectedness, the community.
Yeah.
The family is the domestic church.
Right.
So, of course, we want to encourage others to build that church and to move forward. So at the root of the family is marriage. You cover this so extremely well in your
Thank
book.
You. Yeah.
Could you share some thoughts for us on marriage and the family and what this reflection and the document and what our Holy Father wants families to take away from this?
Yeah. Wow, that's a big question.
Yeah.
But let me take it apart a bit,
sure.
and maybe just answer it in part, and then we can fill it out. But I think one of the amazing things that the Holy Father is doing is he's relocating the center of our attention in marriage and family life.
Yes.
Let me explain that
Beautiful.
A little bit. I think for the people like myself, a priest, even professional lay ministers— mm-hmm. and deacons and religious and so forth. So often, our sense of the church is limited by the day-to-day world that we live in. You know, the structures and the parish and the diocese and so forth.
Yes.
But in fact, the church at its core is an experience of family. You know, St. Paul says in his letter to the Ephesians, you are no longer strangers or aliens, but you are members of the household of God. So we belong to the family of God, and that family is lived out in our families. And I don't know if I'm getting at your question, but to me, this is kind of central that the shift of attention is it could be really remarkable. This could be a pastoral revolution if we really take it up.
Yes.
Because then we'll begin to see, and it's not to ignore the other experiences and the realities of church, parish, diocese, nation, world, communion of saints. These are all dimensions of the church, but it starts and it's held together with an experience of the church in the home, in the family.
By the way, Father Lou stars in our most viewed YouTube video, more than 200,000 views for a tutorial called Draw Near, a video guide to the Catholic Mass. Go to youtube.com/CatholicChicago to enjoy that presentation and thousands of other locally produced Catholic videos. Stick around. In a moment, we'll hear from a group of experts on healthcare. Back after a short break.
What looks more peaceful than a sleeping baby? I'm Monsignor Mike Boland with Catholic Charities. So often mothers and fathers come to us, homeless, hungry, and hopeless, with a sleeping infant. They remind me of a cold, starry night and the mother, father, and their sleeping infant in Bethlehem. Because of your help, there is always room in our inn and hope. Visit us at CatholicCharities.net. God bless you and Merry Christmas.
You're listening to Catholic Chicago Week in Review on Relevant Radio 950 AM and 930 AM. Every Saturday from 9 to 10 AM, the Archdiocese of Chicago presents programming about the people, events, and issues that touch our lives. Thanks for letting us be part of your morning. Now again, Catholic Chicago Week in Review.
Welcome back to Catholic Chicago Week in Review on Relevant Radio 950 and 930 AM. I'm Jim Dish of the Archdiocese of Chicago's Radio TV office. We had a great discussion on Thursday about the dramatic changes that have taken place in the healthcare system. Holy Name Cathedral Rector Father Greg Sakowitz and Graziano Marcheschi of Shalom Media hosted a conversation with the Cardinal's Vicar for Healthcare, Father William Grogan, and several other guests representing the healthcare community.
Give us an overview of healthcare. There's been so many changes, and I think many people are even unaware of what's happening right before us.
Well, thanks very much for having me and our panelists on the phone. We're really grateful for them. And before I say anything else, I want to express thanks on behalf really of the whole church, through Cardinal Supich, for the care all Catholic healthcare providers offer the sick and the vulnerable. And that's especially not only our wonderful people in Catholic institutions, but any Catholic provider, whether in any community or other setting. They've done a great job witnessing to Christ's loving ministry. The overview of healthcare today, we're going to drill down into the Catholic metropolitan area of Chicago. And in drilling it down, one of the things we want to be aware of is we've had the blessing for over 100 years, starting with Mercy Hospital and other hospital settings like St. Anthony, Little Company of Mary, St. James, Chicago Heights, the whole slew of hospitals now within the AMITA world, as well as educational institutions like Loyola University and for many, many years nursing schools attached to the Catholic hospitals and that continue like St. Xavier's or Loyola's Nursing School and Resurrection U.
There's a good number of Catholic providers.
We have in this diocese, I'm going to say, and I didn't even touch on the many, many nursing homes, let alone protective institutions and housing developments with Catholic Charities. We have over 150 Catholic sponsored services.
We'd never have guessed that many.
And that means the employment of thousands of people within Catholic healthcare, which is an evangelical outreach. It's truly the church as a concrete example, the field hospital Pope Francis talks about. And they have four qualities that I think are consistent in a justice and compassionate or loving ministry from Christ, and that is there's a commitment to be present, whether it's a what we used to call Catholic ethnic neighborhood. We have places like St. Bernard's involved with indigent areas, Sinai, Holy Cross, but commitment, compassion, care, not only the provision of care, but the caring individual, And also that express, and this is medicine, concretely. It's not all talk. It is the nurse bedside.
You're talking about the four C's.
The four C's: commitment, compassion, care, and concrete expression. And the big overview today is the challenge of how, with the variation in the way healthcare is advanced, and Dr. Yorena and Laura Messini are going to talk a little bit about this, how this impacts people locally. And that's why I want to turn it over in a moment to Laura and to Susan O'Leary. I'll start with Laura, because the care is often very charitable. It's not bad debt, you know, an unbilled, it's not paid, but it's the undocumented, uninsured come through the doors. This is the big controversy with refugees. And they get care. Whoever walks through that door is stabilized. But the other aspect is, how does that impact great people who are the employers often, if the patient's on a Medicare or Medicaid or some other type of government funding? How does that impact the employer?
Well, Bill, should we turn over now to Susan or to Linda?
Let's go to Linda. And Linda, just to concretely ask, how have you noticed in the HR division an increase, and that is with it a challenge, to have the healthcare costs of our servant employees, so the servants of the church, rise over the last several years?
Absolutely. And just to give you a little background on myself, I oversee our compensation benefits and HR systems within the HR function for the entire enterprise of the Archdiocese. And that phenomenon of these healthcare increases is not alone for our organization. And one of my hobbies is I'm an adjunct professor for DePaul University, and I teach a graduate level course on health benefits. So I'm pretty versed in this topic.
I love that you call that a hobby.
I like that.
Yeah,
never
it is a hobby.
Heard of
it is a hobby.
I thought you could tell me bird watching or coin collecting, and I'm an adjunct faculty member. That's pretty cool.
You'd love my other hobby, but I'm not going to talk about that on the air. but no, I like to give back to the community, and there is so much education for each individual to understand, I think, that employees in general, no matter what role you play, whether you're a priest or an employee of the Archdiocese or any other Catholic, member of our Archdiocese. So costs are going up, and they have always gone up, largely because of overuse of care, which could be intentional or unintentional, in advances in medical treatments, such as, for example, years ago, a preemie baby would have never even survived. But today, a one-pound baby can survive. And guess what? That costs over $1 million. So,
wow. So
some of these increases are directly driven from those advances. But secondly, and most importantly, I wanted to mention, because I have seen numerous research studies that show we as Americans contribute 60 to 70% of our own healthcare costs by our sedentary lifestyles, if we're obese, based on our diet and nutrition, and whether or not we smoke. And 1 in 20 Americans does these five things: regularly exercises, takes in healthy levels of fat, he has 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, he has moderate drinking, and does not smoke. And when I teach this, I say, okay, students, who is doing this? And the statistics are 1 in 20 Americans do this. And absolutely, I get a very few folks that raise their hand. So we can take
control. Wait, was that 1 in 20 does only one of them, or 1 in 20 does all five?
1 in 20 does all five of those.
Okay,
so
guilty as charged.
Yeah, guilty as charged.
Yeah, taking better care of ourselves, we can impact overall health costs by being wiser about how we care for our own bodies.
Now, along those lines, so, then, Susan, it would be, how do you navigate through the new healthcare terrain in light of what Father Bill has said and also what Linda said?
Well, I'm personally blessed, probably because I started life as a physical therapist before I became a healthcare lawyer. And it isn't easy. As we've gone to different ways of providing care, because currently you may have a primary care physician who, if you become ill, will absolutely not deal with you in the hospital. You may well be seen by a hospitalist who's never seen you before. So you have to be, as a consumer, has to become much more proactive, and it isn't easy. You have to know your physician, but you probably should also know his nurse practitioner. You should see them regularly. You should make appointments. You should, most importantly, know how to reach someone in an emergency. And that's something, I will be honest, many of the physician providers and care providers aren't very good at, which is why more and more people are going to things like concierge physicians. If you can afford it, it is someone who does the navigating for you. Because the hard part is hospital emergency rooms are all too often becoming the doctor's office for way too many people.
Hmm. You know, I've noticed over the past year and a half, 2 years, I used to go to my doctor's office. I'd always see my doctor. Now I go to my doctor's office. I see one of his two nurse practitioners, who, thanks be to God, are wonderful and you know, very professional. But is this a growing trend?
It is, absolutely. And interestingly, less so in Illinois, as in states like Michigan and Wisconsin, where it's even larger. And when you get to the rural parts of this country, it is all you see. And is that we're training, interestingly, at the same time, teaching hospitals are training a lot fewer primary care physicians and a lot more specialty physicians. So we're becoming much more a specialty-based practice in the physician group rather than primary care. And you are seeing less and less people going into family care at a time when we need it the most. Someone who can navigate the system for you and plan for you.
Lynn, I want to ask you a question, that is, before you can turn over back to Father Bill, and that is, when you're teaching these graduate students, what's the most commonly asked question of you by the students, or what's one of the biggest myths you have to kind of put down?
Well, I think that the typical American thinks healthcare falls from the sky, and it's just a given that we all have it. And I think that's the biggest myth out there that I get asked about. I think they are stunned about, you know, what was just said about the overuse of care and people going to the emergency room versus a primary care. But the advent of the urgent care facilities are helping, but rural areas, poor people, I totally agree, and I see that a lot, that they are underserved. And it is just, you know, you step back and you think, we're the richest country in the world, yet we let so many people be, you know, left out and underserved when it comes to providing proper health care.
Good. And I appreciate what you said, Linda and Susan. Just very quickly, back to our four values of commitment, care, concrete expressions. One of the aspects that Susan raised very well was the issue of primary care. And to its credit, Catholic Healthcare in Chicago, whether it's at primarily through our residency programs, so the former Presence Health, which was Resurrection and Provena, now under AMITA, the Alexian Ascension system, they have 300 student doctors. And while there are some what we'll call a few subspecialties like obstetrics, which is a general service of medical care for women, the commitment, because of our Catholic commitment in part one of what is called the Bishop's Directives, so the ethical and religious directives, is on primary care. And that goes to our commitment to stay in poor neighborhoods like Englewood or Market Park, where Holy Cross Sinai is, and throughout the whole city, as our commitment to looking compassionately towards population health, which we're going to talk about with Dr. Arena.
Father Bill, why don't you tell us what that term means? What is population health?
Well, thanks for asking me, and I'm going to just tee this up briefly for Dr. Arena because he's the go-to guy on this topic. But think historically, I'm going to be 70 in the spring. When I was a boy, my mom took myself and my four brother sisters off to see Doc. There was the doc in the office, the pediatrician, We saw a doctor with probably his nurse present, and that was the extent of our encountering health care. And health insurance had really just been introduced, and there was an insurance as such, then you paid out of pocket. Now one goes into, and doctor is going to pick up on this, the whole concept that we might take a bad analogy perhaps from church life, and that is while the Catholic goes one-to-one to the priest for confession, the priest looks out from the pulpit and sees the parish. So the social fact, not only of individual one-to-one care, but he sees hundreds of people. And so he, with the parish council and with the archdiocese, plans how to address the religious needs. In medicine, population health, by analogy, is similar. It's, again, our commitment to personalized pro-life care in our concrete ways, but at the same time looking at the bigger picture. And Dr. Urena, I'm going to turn it over to him now and just ask him directly, Doc, what is population health?
Great. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Doctor.
Population health actually comes with a variation in definitions depending on who you ask. But the essential methodology is that you're taking care of patients to a different level now, wherein we look at those factors that influence a patient's health, and then we create policies, intervention, or whatever is needed to affect a positive outcome for those patients. And then, like so much that exists these days, you know, there's some reliance on data that can ultimately drive our understanding of these patients. But kind of what Father alluded to is, you know, one of the biggest changes is that, you know, practices are no longer really, or physicians or providers may not be so much islands managing patients, but you end up having a much more team-based approach.
Well, and Doctor, I think you're at the Amita Medical Group. That's a huge now Catholic system that's really committed to managing the health of thousands of patients within our Catholic philosophy. And you're working with your colleague doctors to try and help them, too, with this shift. I have noticed that the shift really starts in their, if not in their medical school training, but in the residency, the internship programs, as we used to call them, where they learn to work as a team, not only the individual who's got accountability for that patient, because it's one patient at a time. But, Doc, how would you talked a little bit about measurement and outcomes. Isn't it the case now where the physician, driven by good, solid medical evidence, helps design with the patient through maybe a nurse assistant, nurse practitioner, a program to increase those 20% who are rather the 1 in 5 who are doing the 5 healthy behavioral lifestyle changes?
Yeah, I mean, I think it all starts with just culture. You know, we all have different cultures, and we come from different backgrounds, and systems have different cultures themselves. And, you know, for us at Amita, you know, our philosophy and culture is to extend the healing ministry of Jesus. And so, you know, part of it is, you know, how do we do that in a way that, again, is positively going to affect our patients? And so in this team-based approach, you know, we end up using, you know, what I wouldn't have thought of years ago, that you relied on data, but that data really gives us an opportunity to look at subpopulations to understand, you know, what patients' comorbidities are. You know, how do we risk stratify, as we say? How do we put patients into buckets of high risk, that they're in danger, probably more in danger than some other people of having a serious event, to the moderate risk, to the lower risk patients, and eventually get to where all of these patients are managed, even if it's at different levels, but to the level that they deserve, because we're trying to keep all these people healthy if they're healthy, and for those who are sick, we're trying to ensure and maximize their health care.
That entire hour was jammed with information on healthcare, and you can hear that entire conversation and all our Catholic Chicago programs by going to our website, archchicago.org, and clicking on Radio TV. Thanks to our friends here at Relevant Radio 950 and 930 AM for letting us join you every Saturday morning. Thanks for listening. I'm Jim Dish for Catholic Chicago Week in Review. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Join us every Saturday morning for Catholic Chicago Week in Review. You can stream our programs live or listen to past programs by visiting our website, archchicago.org, and clicking on Radio TV. And please connect with Catholic Chicago on social media.